The world is filled with great mysteries, and there is perhaps nothing that thrills the imagination more than the unknown fate of a forlorn expedition into lands unknown. Well, that and perhaps anything paranormal, supernatural, and the unexplained. Now, imagine what happens when you put the two together. Today's story is one shrouded in mystery. It's the tale of an ambitious expedition that met with disaster, resulting in the death and disappearance of 129 souls. The many searches and recovery missions in the years that followed only produced more questions. Why were the abandoned ships found so far apart from each other? Had there been any survivors? Did the crew really resort to cannibalism for survival? And were there some answers found in the spirit world? Today, I'll be telling you the tale of Franklin's Lost Expedition. Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Megan, and welcome back to Haunted History. Well, the beginning of autumn is finally upon us, and it has been a busy couple of weeks around here. I'm sure many of you can relate. It's back to school time, so that means getting back into the swing of things, getting the routine up and going again. So yeah, it's been go, 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 but it's finally starting to settle down a little bit. Something really awesome that I wanted to share. I was looking at the pod details yesterday, the analytics, and we have over 50,000 listeners in 44 countries around the world. My jaw was actually on the floor because I think of this time last year and we had maybe 100 listeners. So we are honestly so grateful for each and every one of you. And it makes me so happy to know that you are loving the stories. And I'm looking forward to our future and the future of the show. And we really can't wait to implement all of the ideas that we have. We want to keep leveling up. This is our passion too. So we want to keep building onto what we already have. And yeah, we're very, very grateful for all of you. You're amazing. Okay, that's enough. That's enough for me. Won't get sappy anymore. It is finally time for today's story. So, let's get to it. Today, we'll be winding the clock all the way back to the latter half of the 19th century. And to better understand what was driving the key players in today's story, first, I'm going to set the stage a little bit. In the late 1800s, a so-called golden age of exploration was underway. There was a strong desire by many to set foot into the most remote parts of the globe. Brought forward mainly by the colonial powers of that time, these expeditions were organized under the banner of scientific questioning, but they were also tinged with a healthy dose of national showmanship. These voyages were also marked, of course, with the colonial impulse to set foot and claim whatever territory the powers that be saw fit. As you can imagine, these powers also had their economic interests at heart. At the time, the layered nature of many great sea voyages extended all the way to the Arctic. Just as the mythical trade route to riches by way of silks and spices informed Columbus 3 centuries prior, there were many who still desired to find a passage through the Arctic Ocean in order to better access trade routes to Asia. It was widely believed, in short, in the existence of an open ocean passage between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. This mythical trade route was known as the Northwest Passage. By the time our story starts, many had tried and failed to find the Northwest Passage. In 1496, John Cabot had tried to find the route to Asia, but his travels landed him in Newfoundland and along the eastern coastline of what is now known as Canada. Many European explorers would also tackle the same objective, and instead, they found an entire continent blocking their way. Gaspar Corte-Real, a Portuguese explorer, sailed to what is now known as Greenland in 1500, and in 1524, Giovanni de Verrazzano, bankrolled by French King Francois I, sailed the eastern coast of what is now known as the United States, from the Carolinas to New England. That same year, Spanish explorer Estevo Gomez also cruised along the eastern coast of the United States, going from Florida all the way up to Newfoundland in Canada. Then, a few short years later, in 1534, Jacques Cartier was confident he had found the passage as he sailed unobstructed through a wide channel. However, this was just the St. Lawrence Gulf, followed by the St. Lawrence River. All of these earlier explorations were fueled by a national desire to be the first to find the Northwest Passage, because ultimately it was synonymous with the promise of untold riches and most certainly prestige. By 1845, the idea that the Northwest Passage involved sailing through an open ocean passage near the Arctic Ocean was considered a fact. So much so that it was simply a question of when and not if it would ever be found. North America, the continent, was no longer an issue. It was just a matter of circumventing the terrain a little. One can imagine that with each expedition, like the ones I spoke of earlier, each perceived failure to discover the fabled Northwest Passage shone some light onto the actual geography and expanse of the land and sea that made up the continent. The evolution of the quest went quite naturally to the north, and all eyes eventually gazed upon its frozen vastness. In 1670, the Hudson's Bay Company was incorporated in England, and with that, a great deal of coastal exploration and mapping occurred. The areas targeted by the company were distinctly northbound, with the idea being that once the Northwest Passage was secured, the company in service of England could profit right away from trading posts on the newly occupied land shoring up to the Arctic Sea. So, essentially, we can see here that a lot of this mapping and exploration was motivated by commerce. Now, something really interesting I'll just mention for those who might not be familiar. I'm not sure how well known this is outside of Canada, but the Hudson Bay Company is mostly known as a department store here. Quite a prolific department store, I would say. I would probably compare it to like a Macy's in the United States. And there might be a better comparison, but that's the only one I can think of right now. So you may be surprised to learn about the HBC's lengthy, dark, and often controversial history. They were heavily involved in the fur trade, and I think there was even a TV show called Frontier that came out around, I'm going to say like 8 years ago now, starring Jason Momoa, and it sort of centered around the monopoly of the fur trade in Canada. It's very fascinating. It's a very fascinating rabbit hole, especially if you're Canadian and you've gone shopping at the Bay. It's worth a little wiki. Okay, so moving on. In the early 1800s, a direct push to find the Northwest Passage became a military focus on behalf of England. This push was spearheaded by a man named John Barrow. You see, Barrow, who was the head of the Admiralty, figured it was high time the Royal Navy itself took upon the onerous task of finding the Northwest Passage. And so with that, he organized many missions that were tasked with exploring the North Pole. Now, these missions were sometimes said to have a scientific backdrop, but the true drive behind them was to find that darned passage. For four decades, mission after mission headed to the North Pole, and for four decades, all of the missions that Barrow organized failed. A long line of explorers over the years, many of which who were part of the British Royal Navy, took it upon themselves to lead the charge and find this mythical Northwest Passage. John Franklin, the head of the Franklin expedition of our story, was actually quite unfavorably described in historical texts. So he was described as being somewhat distinctly unheroic by the standards of the times. A short, stocky man with a prematurely aging hairline, John Franklin may have not been the picture-perfect hero of a nautical novel, but he had a heart brimming with courage, and he was regarded as someone who was good and kind, and he was deeply loved by his wife, Jane. Now, I will say really quickly before moving on, I want you to remember that anytime we recount a story like this, it's really important to acknowledge that historical records tend to err from any of the perspectives of the indigenous peoples that inhabited the lands for millennia. So please just don't forget that it was undoubtedly a different experience for them than what was recorded. So John Franklin was still a man of his time, and he was persistent in finding the Northwest Passage. This desire had taken the shape of an obsession, somewhat, and by the time our story starts, he had no less than 3 failed voyages to the fabled passage under his belt. A couple of factors conspired to make this next part fall into place. First, as I mentioned earlier, with every failed expedition, a better rendering of the overall geography of the land began to form. And so, according to author Anne Saver's book, The Search for the Northwest Passage, there really was only an area of 181,300 square kilometers left to chart out in the Arctic waters. And John Barrow was now in his 80s. And as the idea of retirement loomed near, one can imagine that he wanted to close his career with a highly symbolic act. With the Northwest Passage at seemingly a hair's breadth away, the temptation to put together another mission was just too great to ignore. And so, in 1845, preparations began for another nautical expedition to the North Pole. The route that was to be undertaken by the new expedition would sail west through Lancaster Sound, and it was estimated that the distance traveled would amount to roughly just over 1,600 kilometers. Now, as Barrow combed through candidates to lead this expedition, he was faced with some worrisome or perhaps even ominous hurdles. For starters, Barrow simply couldn't land on the right fit to lead his expedition. He sought out a few men who declined, and one seemed enthused but was subsequently rejected by the Admiralty on account of his young age. However, one man of experience threw his hat in the ring and was actually met with some reluctance by Barrow himself. This man was John Franklin. You see, Franklin was still an explorer at heart, and retirement just didn't suit him. And John Franklin's wife, Lady Jane Franklin, just knew that her husband's heart's desire lay firmly in that icy expanse. She urged him to go, and go he did. Perhaps Sir John Barrow was reluctant to allow John Franklin to command his expedition because he was older. Franklin was 59 years old at the time, or perhaps he had a different vision in his mind as to who would be his proxy in this symbolic act. One thing was for sure, however, Franklin had the gusto, and so he eventually got the job. Now, this wouldn't be haunted history if we didn't point out some of the creepy facts of this story for you. And it's almost glaring when it's presented this way. But the Franklin expedition consisted of 2 ships. And the names of those 2 ships? Why, the Erebus and the Terror, of course. Now, Terror is pretty self-explanatory in terms of being ominous, but Erebus also carries its own negative connotation. The word Erebus has its etymological origins in ancient Greek, and it's tied to darkness and gloom, with the god Erebus being the personification of darkness. Now, these eerily named ships had actually sailed to the Arctic Ocean before. For this voyage, John Franklin was put in command of the HMS Erebus, and his second in command was a man named James Fitzjames. The HMS Terror was headed by a man named Francis Crozier. So what exactly is in a ship that is sailing toward the Arctic in 1845? Glad to answer. And the answer may surprise some. First of all, the ship was, of course, stocked full of food. 3 years' worth, actually. But this wasn't just your run-of-the-mill canned goods, although a gargantuan supply of canned food was stored on board. But no, the ship carried livestock. But survival wasn't the only thing the crew of the Franklin expedition had in mind. No. It seems that since the ships had a lot of modern upgrades to insulate the crew from accidents and from the cold, it could also afford some extra comforts as well. It had entertainment. Records even show that the ships carried around 1,000 books. The Erebus and Terror set sail on May 19, 1845, with 134 souls on board. Of all the men, only six had previously gone on Arctic expeditions. Perhaps one could view that as another ominous hurdle, even though it wasn't uncommon. On the Erebus was our friend John Franklin, his second-in-command, Crozier, a man named John Graham Gore, who served as first lieutenant, and the ship's ice master, James Reed. On the Terror, a man named Alexander MacDonald, who was also the ship's assistant surgeon, had gone to the Arctic before. So had Terror's ice master, Thomas Blanky. An ice master, it should be noted, essentially helps pilot the ship through ice. The first leg of the Franklin expedition took 30 days, and the ships sailed all the way to Greenland. A small transport ship that had been following the expedition, the Barreto Jr., helped prepare the Erebus and Terror for the next, and most perilous, part of their journey. For this, 10 oxen were slaughtered, and the meat was cut, packaged, and loaded onto the ships. It was also here that the expedition sent home five of its men, as they were too sick to go on. So this brought the final tally of men on the Franklin expedition to 129. In late July of that year, in Baffin Bay, a group of whalers happened to stumble upon the Erebus and Terror. The ships were stuck in an ice pack and awaiting the thaws, and of course, their chance to sail up Lancaster Sound as they had planned. This was the last known sighting of the Franklin expedition. The mystery of what happened to the Franklin expedition is not unlike many of the unknown fates that happened to 19th century expedition. Devoid of communication, except for the last batch of letters that the crew wrote to their families as they parted with the Barreto Jr., the Franklin expedition had no way of sending out any timely distress signal. The first leg of the voyage saw men in high spirits, and they had enough provisions to last them 3 years. So, what happened? Out on, and specifically in, the ice, all that could be done was wait. Pack ice made traveling through frozen channels impossible, and sometimes it was that in-between time that proved fatal. The bitter cold was one thing, but there was also disease and starvation. So what do we know of the fate of the Franklin expedition? Well, for a long time, not much was known. And so the lack of answers, desperation, and grief blanketed the surviving family of the lost. One of those people was John Franklin's wife, Lady Jane Franklin. Now, before we chronicle some of the more supernatural aspects of this story, I must situate you with the spirit times once again. And spirit truly is the operative word here, as I'm about to do a minor segue into the concept of spiritualism. Now, aside from the fact that Lady Jane was no doubt racked with grief, this grief was most likely also compounded by the fact that she truly had no closure as to what had happened to her beloved husband, John Franklin. Lady Jane's trauma was appropriately reactionary, and it certainly wasn't an isolated instance. Sometimes grief can feel isolating, but it's universal. In the 19th and early 20th century, a movement came about called spiritualism. This movement, almost religious in its zealotry, proposed essentially that the spirit of a deceased loved one could communicate with the living. And so many charlatans wanted to capitalize on the trauma of war and widespread diseases to make a quick buck on the backs of the grieving. Spiritualism can be viewed critically as a way for some mediums to perpetuate fraud. However, the idea that the veil between the living and the dead is a liminal and penetrable space has existed forever. And in today's story, we'll look at how whispers from the other side may have informed the living on the unknown fate of their loved ones. 2 years after the Franklin expedition set sail, no word had yet come forth as to the state of the expedition. Lady Jane was beside herself with worry, and while the Admiralty assured her that there was nothing to worry about, their words, of course, rang hollow. Lady Jane must have known something was wrong. Sure, these expeditions could take years, but something was off. She just knew it. After pressure from the Parliament and British newspapers, the Admiralty finally launched a rescue party in the spring of 1848. Many search expeditions would ensue, with the bulk of them coming up empty-handed. Early on, searches by sea as well as overland searches found no trace of the Erebus or Terror. Last seen in pack ice, had they ever been dislodged by the icy grip of the sea? Or had the crew been marooned by the elements and left to fend endlessly for themselves? What could be worse than death by freezing? Was it the delirium from hunger or being hunted by a wild animal? What did fate have in store for the 129 men of the Franklin expedition? As more time passed and the less answers they got, the more desperate Lady Jane became. Her plight became the people's plight as well, and the Admiralty had no choice but to transform the rescue mission into a national endeavor. Lady Jane became the figurehead, a mournful yet resolute wife. Privately, she was hinging on desperation, and so she turned to spiritualism for some resolution. For 2 years, as the search parties dragged on without any word of her husband's fate, Lady Jane decided to dabble in the occult. It's said that she consulted with mediums and clairvoyants in order to get some answers as to her husband's fate. One of the most popular modalities, you could say, of spiritualism at the time was that of mesmerists. Okay, so typically a mesmerist was a man who oversaw a woman of lesser societal rank, and then he sent this woman via astral projection to witness events happening in another place entirely. Source material cites two examples of maids being mesmerized by men and giving notes on the state of the Franklin expedition as being disastrous. In both cases, however, the men were said to have still been alive nearly a year into their expedition, if, of course, these projections were to be believed. One of the most documented collaborators of Lady Jane was a young woman named Emma, who was also known as the Seeress of Bolton. She reported that although John Franklin's cheeks were sunken in, he was in overall good spirits. Emma's reports were even considered by the Admiralty, and a representative asked her, map in hand, to pinpoint the exact location of the expedition. Sadly, at this point, Emma seemed to flip-flop, and so the representative declared her to be more or less a fraud. Lady Jane, the newspapers at the time, and the Admiralty all considered mediums and seers during the national campaign to find the Franklin expedition. Although they would later be disavowed, one can only imagine that these special glimpses into her husband's state, stranded yet alive, must have inspired Lady Jane to press on in her time-sensitive search for answers. In 1850, a flotilla of 11 British and 2 American ships sailed through Canadian waters with the aim of finding the now infamous Franklin expedition. Several ships amassed at Beechey Island, and it's there that they found the remains of 3 of the Franklin expedition's crew, along with clear signs that there had been a winter camp set up on the island at some point. The 3 deceased men were found to be John Torrington, John Harnell, and William Brain. In 1854, John Ray was leading an overland search party when he collected evidence of the Franklin expedition's fate. At Pelly Bay, an Inuk person informed John Ray that a group of 40 men had died of starvation near a place called Black River. The Inuk produced several objects that belonged to members of the expedition as proof, namely silver forks and spoons that were noted as belonging to John Franklin, James Fitzjames, Francis Cozier, and two other men from the Erebus, James Walter Fairholm and Robert Orme Sargent. The area that John Ray was searching was the modern-day area of Nunavut, and he urged the Admiralty to send a search party to this area. In July of 1855, James Anderson and a Hudson's Bay employee named James Stewart canoed the Black River. There, they met with a group of Inuit who confirmed John Ray's account. A group of men had starved and died at the mouth of that very same river. The next month, Anderson and Stewart would find a piece of wood with the inscription Erebus on an island near the channel where the Black River meets the sea. Finally, clues as to what happened to the Franklin expedition were beginning to trickle in. Lady Jane was not soothed in the least by these discoveries. What were clues for some were teasing fragments to her, pieces of a puzzle she desperately tried to put back together, even if only for her own sanity. When the Admiralty declined to send out another search party, declaring the crew dead in service on March 31st, she decided to take matters into her own hand. This could have also been initiated by the fact that she was told by mediums, rather directly or indirectly, that her husband was still alive. On July 2nd, 1857, a ship named Fox departed Aberdeen. This privately commissioned vessel was captained by a man named Francis Leopold McClintock and sanctioned, of course, by Lady Jane. McClintock had led other search parties for the Franklin expedition before, but this voyage centered around a new approach. McClintock planned to deploy a team on sleds overland from the ship in order to execute a wide-scoping search by both land and sea. Inuit had previously pointed to King William Island as the final resting place of many of the men of the Franklin expedition. So, in April of 1859, a team on sleds were dropped off at King William Island. Led by one William Hobson, the group would find the infamous Victory Point note. This note detailed, among other things, the deaths of several crewmen, including John Franklin, and how a group of surviving members decided to trek south to the mainland. The winter camp at Beachy Island, it was discovered, had been the crew's camp during the winter of 1845 to 1846, the very first winter. When Emma, the seeress of Bolton, had claimed to be witnessing John Franklin alive, he had already been long dead. Lady Jane finally had learned the fate of her husband, and her quest for answers had given her some closure, although not quite the outcome she had hoped for, of course. Over the next 20 years, expeditions would go back to the island, each one venturing deeper and deeper by sled into the expanse, many relying on communication with the local Inuit to piece together the last whereabouts or resting places of members of the Franklin expedition. Many skeletal remains were sent back overseas for burial. During these treks, the nature and scope of sledding across the ice fields was honed, with the longest successful run being completed by adopting an Inuit diet for subsistence. In the 1980s, Professor Owen Beattie spearheaded the modern forensic anthropological survey of the Franklin expedition. His explorations and research found high levels of lead in the remains of the crew and noted that certain marks on the bones suggested that perhaps there had been instances of survival cannibalism amongst the crew members. Poorly soldered tin cans, Beattie theorized, could have been one of the sources of lead exposure, which may have caused members of the group to become sick and perish. Forensic analysis of the bodies buried at Beachy Island would support a high level of lead, but couldn't account for whether or not this level was the result of a lifetime of exposure or a a short burst of the toxic compound. The analysis of the bodies at Beachy did reveal something else, though, and this was perhaps that pneumonia was the cause of the lethal undoing of many of the members of the Franklin expedition. Then, in the 1990s, renewed academic expeditions on King William Island unearthed something grisly. Remains that were found showed marks of defleshing and bones that had been pot polished, which is when the bones are cooked in a pot and their marrow is sucked dry. On September 9th, 2014, the Victoria Strait Expedition, organized by Parks Canada, found the wreck of the HMS Erebus. She was lying in 11 meters of water near O'Reilly Island. Then, on September 12th, 2016, the Arctic Research Foundation found the wreck of the HMS Terror. It was just south of King William Island. The mystery of what happened to Franklin's lost expedition endured for centuries. When the wrecks were finally found, more questions arose, however. First of all, the Terror was found last and was located 100 kilometers north from the wreckage of the Erebus. Why were the ships so far apart? What's more, although there is some distance between them, the ships are located in almost identical longitudinal lines. According to the Victory Point note, both ships had been abandoned in the Victoria Strait, an area that would correspond to a place north of where the Terror would eventually be found. So why were the wrecks located south of the Victoria Strait? And why were they so far apart? Well, one theory is that the Terror was probably remanned at some point. Remember, the Victory Point note stated that a group of crewmen had broken off after first abandoning the ship and marched south toward Black River. Had they turned back when the sea ice broke up and tried their luck at sailing again? David Woodman, an author who gathered Inuit testimony regarding the whereabouts of the Franklin expedition, certainly thinks so. The retired BC Ferries captain wrote a book on the Franklin expedition titled Unraveling the Franklin Mystery, Inuit Testimony. He believes it's the testimony of the Inuit people that holds the key to unearthing what happened to Franklin's lost expedition. The testimony detailed in his book suggests that the men reboarded the ships after the original marooning of 1848, and they attempted to sail them once again. However, it appears that one ship sank quickly, most likely due to having a hole in the hull. According to Parks Canada, the potent nature of Inuit oral storytelling and tradition is exemplified in the fact that this knowledge helped scientists narrow down the search area for the wrecks and directly led to their discovery. Scientists are of the opinion that it would be very unlikely that the ships would have drifted naturally from the Victoria Strait to their final resting places. Inuit stories suggest that the members of the Franklin expedition survived for years after first abandoning their ships. The exact nature of their deaths is theorized as most likely being a combination of hypothermia, sickness, and starvation. The details of the Franklin expedition's fate will always be shrouded in mystery. One thing's for sure, John Franklin was a man who loved what he did. And as I said earlier, every expedition that ended in perceived failure paved the way for the next. Surely, Franklin knew the dangers of what he was facing, but the idea of exploring or taming the expanse must have been intoxicating. And for Lady Jane, not knowing and being driven into resolution tinged with desperation by grief must have pushed her to seek answers, like her husband, into the great unknown. And that, my friends, is the story of the Franklin Expedition. I hope you enjoyed this tale, and I will see you next time for more Haunted History.